rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, to the Tom Hartman radio program, where democracy will not be downsized. You are in the no boring zone. Welcome, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, Live 365's American FM. Well, we have ghouls, ghosts, goblins, and dollars. The currency collapsing. The Bush administration. You're not going to believe. This is going to absolutely astound you. Who the Bush administration has appointed to be the acting director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We'll get to that in a minute. First, though, this is one of the reasons why I don't sign online petitions. People send me these online petitions. Hey, you got to sign this online petition to save the gophers in Kansas or whatever it may be. And very often they're causes that I absolutely agree with. And occasionally they are groups that I do sign up with. I mean, I did give MoveOn.org my information. I did give Democracy for America my personal information. When I contributed, when Barbara Boxer was trying to raise some money to stop whatever the particular insanity it was, I forget at the time, I gave them my personal information. But very, very often, you know, I get these requests, and I get steered to these websites where it says, please sign this petition. By the way, give us your name and your address and your phone number, or just your email address. And I'm sorry, I just don't do it. Because so often on these websites, it doesn't say what it says on our website, for example, on my website, which is that I will never sell your information. I will never rent your information. I will never loan your information. It's not used by anybody. I mean, somebody signs up for our newsletter. We have a regular newsletter that goes out. You can sign up at tomhartman.com. A thinly veiled plug there. But there's no financial anything in the newsletter. There's no pitch for money. There's no advertising. It's my most recent column that I've written for commondreams.org and that gets published around the web. And we also have one for attention deficit disorder, and it's just my most recent writings. That's all. Pure and simple. I pay to have it, you know, to have the company, that manages, that provides the software, right, that provides it. But, this is not a business deal. And there are a few good ethical folks out there who are doing that. I like to think of myself in that category. But there are a lot of people who are simply harvesting names. And sometimes from the most well-meaning people on both the right and the left. And then they sell those names. And people wonder how they got on these spam lists. And so here we find, I mentioned this yesterday, now we have the actual text. This is incredible. I mean, you go to this company, this direct marketing firm that is now selling the list, and here's Response Unlimited, and here's the description, and I quote, these compassionate pro-lifers donated toward Bob Schindler's legal battle to keep Terry's estranged husband from removing the feeding tube from Terry. These individuals are passionate about the way they value human life, adamantly oppose euthanasia, and are pro-life in every sense of the word, ! And by the way, you can get their names for $500 a month. You recall Gary McCullough? Gary McCullough is the guy who defended murderer Michael Griffin by claiming, this by way from a blog that was on CNN yesterday that was forwarded to me by Mark Crispin Miller. Michael Griffin he's the one who defended the murderer, Michael Griffin, by claiming that killing an abortion provider is, quote, justifiable homicide, end quote, who is closely associated with double murderer Paul Hill. He funneled money to Clayton Wagner, the anti-abortion terrorist who sent those anthrax hoax letters to abortion clinics. And Michael Griffin claims he's been arrested more than 30 times. for his involvement in disruptive abortion protests. He has been the guy who has been identified in the press as a Schindler family spokesman, of all things. Rather strange. Randall Terry, another one of the spokesmen for the Schindler family, you can buy for $90 a list. His list is a lot cheaper. You can rent his list, 73,465 names. Again, Response Unlimited. This unique master file allows you to target donors to Randall Terry, the best-selling author, activist, musician, politician that the New York Times has referred to as an icon of the pro-life movement. Randall Terry is best known for passionately defending the unborn for more than a decade and a half. In more recent years, Randall has been a vocal critic of special rights for homosexuals, gay marriage, and any other radical positions of the homosexual agenda. You want Alan Keyes' donors to his 96 presidential campaign? $85 a thousand. There's 74,871 of them. These are hardcore donors and supporters who believe America is in the process of self-destructing because of the loss of moral principle. And cheapest of all, for $70 a thousand, you can rent the 142,862 names in Lou Sheldon's Traditional Values Coalition. Again, the cell copies is probably the nation's most effective organization in lobbying Congress and state capitals in opposition to the radical gay rights agenda, as well as against the acceptance of degrading social concerns to traditional Americans like abortion, pornography, pedophilia, and lowering the age of sexual consent. Yeah. Anything for a buck. Anything for a buck. Well, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense. The right, broadly, you know, in quotes, is made up of a coalition of economic conservatives, those who believe that the golden rule should apply, right? He who has the gold makes the rules. And so-called social conservatives, those who want to go back to the biblical days where we, like Saudi Arabia, every Friday they have the public executions in Jeddah. And it's like, perhaps they don't want to go back that far, but you get the point. And so it shouldn't surprise anybody that the social conservatives are being exploited by the fiscal conservatives. Gee, what a surprise. Speaking of conservatives and President Bush, President Bush's top domestic policy advisor, Claude A. Allen. This is the guy who advises the president on what to do domestically. He's the one who would say to George W. Bush, you know, you really ought to go to Washington, D.C. and sign that law to save Terri Schiavo's, you know, or at least her body's life. Well, the Washington Post reports that Claude A. Allen, the top domestic policy advisor to George W. Bush, although I would say probably that role is truly filled by Karl Rove, but nonetheless, the official one. Allen counts the controversial Jesse Helms as a mentor, calling him a man of integrity and principle. We are now quoting from Claude A. Allen. He's speaking of Jesse Helms' position with regard to the Martin Luther King holiday, why there should not be one. And Claude A. Allen, George W. Bush's number one domestic policy advisor, said, and I quote, King was linked to communists, that the holiday cost too much, and that individuals should not be granted hot national holidays were legitimate. In other words, these concerns of Jesse Helms. David Sirota notes, and this is from a piece that David Sirota wrote today, notes that George W. Bush was the first president in the modern era not to address the NAACP, and in 2004 he actually used Martin Luther King Day as a cheap excuse to force taxpayers to pay for his trip to Atlanta, where he visited King's grave for all of a few minutes and then spent the rest of the holiday holding lavish fundraisers for himself with his big donors. But none of that rises to the level of obscenity. Of absurdity. I mean, this has got, you would think that this came out of South Park or The Simpsons. Only the writers of The Daily Show could come up with this, you would think. The Humane Society of the United States is a little upset, shall we say. Interior Secretary Gail Norton has named Matthew J. Hogan to be acting director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, who the heck is Matthew J. Hogan, and what does the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service do? Well, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, just kind of broadly speaking, is in charge of protecting fish and wildlife in the United States. This, I suppose, should not be a secret. It's also the agency that's responsible for granting or denying permits to import into the United States animals killed outside the United States by trophy hunters. So if a trophy hunter, say it's illegal in the United States to kill an endangered species animal, but it's not illegal in Uzbekistan. So a trophy hunter goes over to Uzbekistan and blows away some endangered species. In order to get it back into the United States, they have to get a permit from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Those permits very often denied. Well, now the guy who is going to be in charge of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, thanks to George W. Bush and Interior Secretary Gail Norton, a fellow by the name of Matthew J. Hogan, was formerly the chief lobbyist for Safari Club International, SCI, Safari Club International, an extreme trophy hunting organization that advocates the killing of rare species around the world. Are you listening to this? They have 40,000 wealthy trophy collectors. SCI members shoot prescribed lists of animals to win so-called Grand Slam and Inner Circle titles. There's the African Big Five, the leopard, elephant, lion, rhino, and buffalo. The North American 29, all species of bear, bison, sheep, moose, caribou, and deer. Big cats of the world, antlered games of the America, and many other contests put on by SCI. To complete all 29 award categories, a hunter must kill a minimum of 322 separate species and subspecies, enough to populate a large zoo. Because this is an extremely expensive and lengthy task, many SCI members take the quick and easy route to see their names in the record books. They shoot captive animals in canned hunts, many of them overseas, shooting animals over bait from vehicles with spotlights on the edge of national parks. Prominent SCI hunter Kenneth E. Baring donated $100 million to the Smithsonian's National History Museum, and according to published reports, tried to get the museum's help in importing a rare Karutau Argali sheep, which he had killed in Kazakhstan and had shipped to a Canadian taxidermist. One of only 100 such sheep alive remaining in the world. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, now under Hogan's watch, is the agency charged with granting or denying such trophy import permits. Welcome, my friends, to Bush World. Here we are again. It's remarkable. It's Tom Hartman, the life support system for democracy in America, 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
But that's not what I really wanted to talk about. I just couldn't pass it up. It was just, what is going on? These people, well, I guess the big game hunters are rejoicing. Especially those who like to go over to foreign countries where they take endangered species and put them in a pen and hand them an elephant gun and say, there, shoot! These guys, so they can hang it on the wall and say, look it, I really do have a big one after all. Right? Yeah, I guess we need not go any further with that. We have added $416 billion. Notes, David, he doesn't say where he's located, so anyhow, Dave, he sends me a note. He said, we've added $416 billion to our debt since the end of fiscal year 2004. That would have been last October. We ended then with $7.369 trillion, and now we are at $7.785 trillion. You can read about it on the web at publicdebt.treas.gov. He says, cool, we're on track to add $832 billion in debt to the United States this year alone. Now, just put that in your bio computer for a moment, because we're going to come back around to it. I want to share with you, first I'm going to share with you a little bit of a comment from Alan Greenspan and something that's happening in Iran. And then you're going to hear me talking about David M. Walker, the 7th Comptroller General of the United States, and something he had to say that every American should be hearing. This one of the most shocking things that I have heard, or read in this case, to come from a high official in the United States government in a long, long time. We're talking some radical truth-telling here. We'll get to that in a few minutes, probably after the next break. Here we have now, keep in mind, Greenspan, when George W. wanted to cut taxes in 2001, and of course, everybody understood, or at least everybody on the right understood, and by everybody on the right, I'm not talking about the average guy who's listening to right-wing talk radio. I'm talking about the ruling elite on the right, the Rupert Murdochs on the right, the big corporations on the right, the ruling elite on the right. How else can you say it? They all understood that this was part of a very carefully crafted strategy to do two things. Number one, to help create a permanent overclass and underclass in the United States, because that provides for greater stability in government. They say, this is their position. This is the conservative position. If you have very, very wealthy people, permanently very wealthy, and you insulate their wealth by doing away with things like the so-called death tax, the inheritance tax, and you have a large percentage of people who are terribly poor and terrified and politically impotent, they don't have the time to get involved in politics, they're so busy just trying to make a living, that in the mind of conservatives, and this is, goes back to Edmund Burke, this goes back to the 1600s, that in the mind of conservatives will provide for a politically stable country. So Greenspan endorsed Bush's tax cuts, which accomplished two things. One, transferred trillions of dollars to millionaires and billionaires in the United States, depending on the event horizon, anywhere from $1 to $16 trillion. You want to look at a 10-year period or a 75-year period. And number two, starved the beast. In other words, reduced the amount of government revenue available for those terrible, what the conservatives view as socialist programs like Social Security, Medicare, unemployment payments, child welfare payments, aid to families with dependent children, Head Start programs, childhood vaccination programs, all those kinds of things. We'd simply be able to say, hey, there's a budget crisis. And Greenspan at the time had been an outspoken advocate of Reaganomics. Well, Greenspan has since had a change of heart. And the reason why, of course, in my opinion, is because in 6 months he's not going to be the head of the Fed anymore, and he's thinking about his legacy, and he's trying to, his irrational exuberance statement during the stock market run-up, he's trying to get on the record about this. I'll share it with you right after this. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Lips of Chris's right. Rates of Chris's left.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Keeping democracy alive, even as corporations trying to pull a plug and sell off the body parts. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. Greenspan in 2001, now looking back on 2001, when Greenspan was testifying before Senator Hillary Clinton, he essentially said, maybe it was a mistake to support those tax cuts because they led to so much debt. Gee, what a surprise. You see, the cons have been pushing this thing ever since Reagan. Run the country into debt, run it into a disaster, run it off the edge of the bridge. And then instead of rescuing it by you know, raising taxes and having some programs that enjoy wide and broad public support and that actually raise the standard of living of the average American, what we will be able to do is do away with these terrible socialist programs like Social Security. We'll be able to privatize them. We'll turn all this stuff over to the corporations and everything will be just fine. That's their opinion. They're nuts, but it's their opinion. And then at the Bankers Club in New York last week, Greenspan comes out and says that he should have spoken up back when Reagan and Bush and Quayle were running up trillions of dollars worth of debt. Now, why would this be? Well, because they're seeing the debt bomb about to blow up in their face. Now, let me tell you about David Walker. David Walker is the 7th Comptroller General of the United States. This is a 15-year term. This is a guy independent of politics, or at least he's supposed to be. David Walker was appointed in 1998, November 9th, 1998, to a 15-year term. As such, he is the head of the U.S. Government Accountability Office, the GAO, which was founded in 1921. He's the 7th person to lead it. Before that, he served as a public trustee for Social Security and Medicare from 1990 to 1995. Before that, he was the Assistant Secretary of Labor for Pension and Welfare Benefit Programs, this under Reagan and Bush, from 1987 to 1989. And in 1985, under Reagan, he was the Acting Executive Director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. That's the government agency that bails out private corporate pensions when they go broke. This is a guy who has worked for the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, it was appointed by the Clinton administration to be the head of the GAO. He's a CPA. He's got a BS degree, Bachelor's of Science degree in accounting, Senior Management and Government Certificate from John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, a doctorate, honorary doctorate in BA in Business Administration from Bryant College, and you know, on and on it goes. Okay, this guy is no slouch. And he's not a hack. It's not like listening to Jon Snow, for example. Well, in February of this year, this, you know, last month, January, February, March, yeah, this is March, and last month, he gave a keynote address at the National Press Club. And I am simply astounded. It took me this long to figure out that this thing happened. It apparently wasn't widely reported, or if it was, I must have been out to lunch that day. But I have the transcript of the entire speech. And I just want to share a few excerpts with you. Keep in mind, this is the Comptroller General of the United States. This is the guy whose job is to keep us honest. Congress, the White House, the courts, whatever. The Comptroller General of the United States, the Honorable David M. Walker, from a speech he gave before the National Press Club on February 2nd, 2005. Just a few weeks ago. Well, 8 weeks ago. He talks about a problem. He says he wants to speak about a problem. He says that problem is our nation's worsening financial condition and long-range fiscal outlook. He goes on to add, we now confront three large and interrelated national deficits. And this is what I keep saying in this program. Most people, you say deficit or debt, and they are clueless. They don't realize there's three of them. There's the budget deficit. That's the amount of money that we spent this year, the amount of money that we're spending this year that we're not bringing in tax receipts. And so we're having to borrow. There is the balance of payments deficit. That is the amount of stuff we buy from overseas that we don't sell to overseas to balance out. So we end up having to give them IOUs. We have to borrow money from China in order to buy stuff from China. So they end up with the benefit of having sold us stuff. In other words, they get the employment. Plus, we owe them money. And the third, he notes, is the alarming personal savings deficit, the fact that the average American is in debt up to their eyeballs, mostly through home mortgages. Now, you can add to that, by the way, I would add to that, the the total debt of the United States, which is not considered a deficit, it's considered a debt, which is now over $7 trillion. It was less than $1 trillion. It had never been, it had never even approached $1 trillion until Ronald Reagan came into office. The $7 trillion debt that you are seeing is the result, pure and simple, of supply-side economics, so-called trickle-down economics, Lafler, all this nonsense, Reaganomics, Bushonomics, whatever you want to call it. All it boils down to is borrow like crazy so you can live good and make things look good so you can fool the people so they'll elect you again. And while you're borrowing, be sure to give a pile of that money to your rich buddies, to the millionaires and billionaires. Well, anyhow, here, David M. Walker, the Comptroller of the Currency, or of the United States, Comptroller General of the United States, says, the American people need to realize that the fiscal choices being made in Washington today have profound consequences for the future of our country and our children. He quotes Walter Shapiro in USA Today. He says, low interest rates and modest inflation give many Americans a false sense of security. These false perceptions are reinforced by the government's financial statements, which currently do not provide a full and fair view of our nation's current financial condition or long-term outlet. What? Outlook, excuse me. What? George Bush is lying to us? Last year, he says, last year, 2004, the federal government experienced a deficit that averaged more than $1 billion each and every day. That's more than $750,000 a minute. I'm quoting from the Comptroller General of the United States. He says, if you're honest about keeping score, the federal government's obligations, current liabilities, and unfunded fiscal commitments are over $43 trillion and rising. Now, just put that number in your brain for a minute, $43 trillion. The Comptroller General of the United States says that's how much we're in hock. He goes on to say the last year alone, this amount has risen by more than $13 trillion. In the last year, $13 trillion, largely due to the new Medicare prescription drug benefit. Yes, that's trillions. I'm quoting again from the Comptroller General of the United States. Yes, that's trillions with 12 zeros rather than billions with 9 zeros. To put that number into perspective, he says, even with the recent run-up in housing prices, the estimated total net worth of every American, including Bill Gates and other billionaires, is only $47 trillion. So the net worth of every American in the United States, the net worth of all of us combined, including billionaires like Bill Gates, is $47 trillion. We are in debt, he says, to the tune of $43 trillion. Again, quoting the Comptroller General of the United States, that means that every American would have to fork over more than 90% of their net worth to cover the government's current promises. Stated differently, the current burden for every American works out to more than $145,000. The numbers are even worse for full-time workers, whose share now exceeds $350,000. For this you can thank Ronald Reagan, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr. Bill Clinton was the first president to have the cojones to try and turn this thing around. And he did it. He pushed through the tax increase legislation that brought us the first balanced budget in 100 years. He pushed it through without one single Republican vote. The Republicans saying this is going to bankrupt America. It's going to cause a great crash. It'll cause a great collapse. What did it do? It brought us a budget surplus. It allowed us to begin paying down our debt. It brought unprecedented prosperity to the United States. It created jobs. Oh, it led to a stock market bubble. Well, maybe it was a bubble. I don't know. The stock market's pushing back up into those regions again. Maybe it's just that George W. Bush, with his insane economic policies, dragged the stock market down for 4 years. Let's go back to the Comptroller of the Comptroller General of the United States. He adds, as bad as these numbers are, it's the real-life consequences of unchecked deficits that are truly frightening. What? We're not truly frightened? For example, he says, if we continue as we have, higher interest rates are inevitable. It's only a matter of when and how high. As government borrows more and more money to finance its debt, Less money will be available for companies to invest in and to stay competitive in today's global economy. Without meaningful changes, long-term economic growth will suffer, and along with it, American jobs and purchasing power. And don't forget that high budget deficits can lead to slower growth, higher interest rates, and higher inflations, which in many respects is the cruelest tax of all. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. Thank you, George Bush Sr. Thank you, George E.W. Jr. He goes on to say, again, we are quoting now from 8-9 weeks ago, keynote address to the National Press Club by the Honorable David M. Walker, Comptroller General of the United States. By continuing to run huge budget deficits, America is partially ceding control over its own destiny to others. Why? Because America's personal savings rates has reached historic lows. So guess who's been financing much of our spending spree in recent years? The answer is foreign investors. Since 1993, the share of publicly held debt owned by foreign investors has more than doubled. This since 1993, from 19% to over 40%. Last year, foreign investors purchased nearly $399 billion in Treasury securities, just $13 billion less than the size of the deficit. In other words, we, the rich people in America who can afford to buy government bonds, financed $13 billion of our deficit. Foreigners financed $399 billion of our deficit. They own us. In fact, he goes on to say, if these foreign investors lose confidence in U.S. securities as a safe haven and start to move their money elsewhere, we're going to get to that in a minute, our economy may take a serious and sudden hit. The recent decline in the value of the dollar may be a warning shot in this regard. Why wasn't this on the front page of the New York Times? He goes on to say, in the past, particularly in the decades since World War II, America was the world's great engine of economic growth. Now, he wouldn't be so unkind as to say, thanks to Bushonomics and Reaganomics, we no longer are, and not to mention Bill Clinton's free trade policies. But he goes on to say, our long-term fiscal gap is so great today that there's no way we'll be able to grow our way out of the problems. That's George Bush's solution. He says, if you just give enough money to rich people, enough tax cuts, borrow enough money from our grandchildren and give it to the rich people right now, they will create jobs and grow our way out of it. Fact of the matter is, they are creating jobs in China, in Burma, in Thailand, in Vietnam. But certainly not in Boise. But even if you were to accept the insane babble that is coming out of the right wing, we can grow our way out of this. The Comptroller General of the United States says, no, not possible. He says, using plausible assumptions, closing our fiscal gap would require average real growth in double digits. That's over 10% for the next 75 years. By any measure, that's unrealistic. In fact, even during the boom years of the 1990s, the economy grew at an average annual real rate of only 3.2%. In other words, it's impossible. So how do we start to turn things around, he asks. At the federal level, a crucial first step is to insist on truth and transparency in government operations. Oh, my. And George W. is saying, hey, it is fine for us to spend hundreds of millions of dollars of your money to create phony press releases, to pay off phony columnists, to give money to Armstrong Williams and his legion of people to write phony to send this stuff. And there's no problem lying to the American people. He also says, this is the Comptroller General of the United States. He says, the time has come to reinstate budget controls such as reasonable spending caps and responsible pay-go rules. Remember what George W. was ridiculing during the debates with John Kerry? Which would require any new spending increases or tax cuts to be paid for by equivalent tax increases or spending cuts. He adds, today, many, if not most, government policies and programs are based on conditions that existed when Harry Truman or Dwight Eisenhower were president. This, of course, before Ronald Reagan started deconstructing the American economy. It goes on and on. I mean, he says, somehow in the last 200 years, we seem to have forgotten the sound advice from Washington Hamilton, and Franklin. If the Founding Fathers were to return today, I have no doubt they'd be justifiably proud of the many things we've accomplished, but I suspect many of them would be shocked and saddened by our willingness to forego fiscal discipline and pile on both personal and public debt. It's likely that our Founding Fathers would see our mounting debt as a violation of our stewardship responsibility to future generations of America. He said the debate about our fiscal future is ultimately not about numbers, but about values. The debate we are really having is about the kind of world we're prepared to pass on to our children and our grandchildren. And I'm telling you, and he's absolutely right. That's what it boils down to. Do you want to go along with George W. Bush and the cons and the Republicans and the conservative Democrats, the DLC Democrats, and pile the debt on so that our children are inheriting $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 worth of debt in birth tax that they're born with? Or are we going to do something about it? 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want.
Yeah, but you got to get politically active. You got to go out there and join the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the Green Party. Sign up at Democracy for America for one of the meetups. Get out there, get involved. It actually produces something called social capital. It makes our nation stronger, it makes our culture stronger, and it's how you bring back democracy in the United States. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Tom in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Tom, what's on your mind today?
Morning, Tom. Yeah, this dovetails right in about being politically active. I wanted to relay to you this confrontation I had this morning on Minnesota Public Radio. It was with this conservative guy from the Public Policy Institute from California. They're a right-wing think tank, right?
It's hard to keep them straight these days.
Yeah, I know. Do I have a minute or two to relate the story?
Yeah, we have a minute and a half.
Okay. Because this will illustrate how your listeners and your fans of your writings are on the front lines fighting these cranks here. But first, real quick, here's a quick two-word soundbite for economic conservatives and social conservatives. Just say the unholy alliance between the plutocrats and the preachers.
Yeah, well, the problem is most people don't know what plutocrat means. But, I don't disagree with you, yeah.
Okay.
I'd say between the billionaires and the preachers, but whatever you want.
Well,
in any case.
It was interesting, too, when you said Jesse Helms, quote, Martin Luther King was a communist, he said?
Yeah, well, no, he said he was involved with communists.
Ah, so a devout man from the religious left promoting justice and democracy in the workplace is a communist.
Well, was involved with the communists, yeah. And well, see, the fact of the matter is when Jesse Helms said that back in the 50s and 60s, there were a lot of people who believed that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, and it was, you know, it was fairly widely reported, actually. So I'm not, you know, he was wrong.
Right.
And I'm not going to criticize Jesse Helms in the 50s for believing that.
Well,
I will
right
criticize
in
this guy who Clinton, or who Bush just appointed, for saying today that he still agrees with it.
Well, this goes right into what I've always said, how they try to conflate the two terms, democracy and capitalism. So a guy who promotes people power in the workplace, which promotes distribution of voices, is equated with communist distribution, right?
Yeah.
And they define democracy as unfettered capitalism. Of course, we define it the true way, which is democracy, which promotes distribution of power. Anyway, this guy, David Newmark, from the Public Policy Institute.
We've got about 15 seconds here, Tom.
Ain't going to work.
Ain't going to work. Okay. Why don't you call back later on in the day, and I'll let you share the story.
Good.
Okay, because I'd love to hear the story.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Okay, and I appreciate your calling. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask the question, if democracy in America were a car, would you want it to be a 74 Pinto, a Prius, or a Hummer? That's an interesting question, actually, as a Prius driver. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Something strange going on here in the People's Republic. We have lost all our power. So I'm letting our affiliates know, those who are listening, we are running on generator power right here from the People's Republic of Vermont. Of course, Mercury's retrograde. That probably has something to do with it. In any case, we're right. We've got the generator out in front of the building that I went out and cranked the thing away, got it working. And if there's a funny hum in the line, that might have something to do with the fact that this whole thing is being brought to you now by a gallon of gasoline. And when we run out of gas, hopefully there's 2 hours worth of gas in the generator. Because this part of our town, or at least this house, has lost all its electricity. I have no idea what's going on. I don't know if somebody brought down a tree, brought down a power line, whatever it is, in any case. But we're still here. We're not dead yet, as Monty Python goes. I guess it gets a little bizarre when you put it in the context of Terry Schiavo. But in any case, here we are, and moving along with the program. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number if you'd like to call in. TomHartman.com, our website if you'd like to drop by. Who is it? Bringer Non. This is Thomas Powerless. Yeah. No, we have our own power. We have our own power system. We installed it last year, and here we go. We're running. So, anyhow, we're still here. Iran. I just have to get into this. This is just really quite mind-boggling. And by the way, just in the context of all this losing power thing, to let our affiliate stations know that if we drop, we're letting Jones, our satellite provider, know, and they'll plug in an older show, although we may lose our web stream. But that seems to be still running. So we'll find out. Anyhow, Louise is on the phone. We're going to find out what's going on. Iran does not oppose a threat to the United States because of its nuclear projects, its weapons of mass destruction, or anything like that. This is Dr. Elias Akhlai in this very interesting and thought-provoking article from the Arabic Media Internet Network. He says, Iran does not pose a threat to the U.S. because of its nuclear projects. He said, but its attempt to reshape the global economic system. This is the real threat to the United States. Apparently, Iran is now talking the same way Saddam Hussein was talking about the time that all of a sudden we decided, hey, we got to get this guy. Specifically, converting from a petrodollar to a petro-euro. See, right now, worldwide, dollars are denominated, or oil is denominated in dollars. And Hussein said, I'm not going to take dollars for my own oil anymore. I'm only going to take euros. And when he first started doing that, he actually lost money because the value of the euro was going down relative to the dollar. And then he started making money as the value of the dollar started to drop. Once George W. Bush came into office and started killing off our economy, killing off the dollar, deficit spending, proposing his insane tax policies. So-called tax policies, his insane borrow from our children and our grandchildren, call it a tax cut, give that borrowed money to rich people, and then and spend as much of it in the government as you can, ever since he started doing this. But in its attempt to reshape the global economic system by converting it from petrodollar to petro-euro system, such conversion is looked upon as a flagrant declaration of economic war against the U.S., eventually might cause an economic collapse. Hey, Ira, while you're out there, run over to the thermostat and turn the temperature down to like 60 so the furnace doesn't come on and kill the generator. We don't know if it'll sustain the heating system here as well as the everything else. I'd hate to lose our signal here just because we needed heat. Oil-consuming countries have no choice but to use the American dollar to purchase their oil, since the dollar has been so far the global standard monetary fund for oil exchange. This necessitates these countries to keep the dollar in their central banks as their reserve fund, thus strengthening the American economy. Do you get it? The only reason that particularly the large industrial countries in the world, for example, China, India, the only reason that they have to hang on to dollars is because they have to buy oil. And oil, anywhere in the world that you want to buy oil, you have to pay for it with dollars because there's these, you know, benchmark prices. There are three of them. Sweet Texas crude is one. There's two others. I forget what they are. And these benchmark prices are always defined in dollars. So they would have to come up with a new benchmark. The West Texas Intermediate crude is one, the WTI, the Norway Brent crude is another, and the UAE Dubai crude, that's another. They're all based in dollars. So somebody would have to come up with a euro currency, a petro-euro. How do we do that? But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. dollar is sinking through the floor as a result of the insane economic policies that have been inflicted on this nation ever since Ronald Reagan bought into what George Herbert Walker Bush correctly called voodoo economics and turned us from the economic powerhouse of the world to the economic weakling of the world, turned us from the world's largest producer of goods and services to the world's largest consumer of goods and services, turned us from the world's largest bank, the world's largest creditor, the world's largest lender of funds, to the world's largest debtor, the world's largest pauper. And, you know, is the solution run for the hills? Is the solution, you know, move out to Montana and join a militia? And no. The solution is, frankly, not that difficult. Bill Clinton showed us this. He did some insane stuff with regard to international trade policy. I will be the first to tell you that. And yet, when it came to domestic taxation policy, he raised taxes a couple of points. And balanced the budget. And even generated a surplus. And what happened? Well, you know, the government's not siphoning off all this money to pay for borrowing. There's more money for economic activity. There's more money for business. I mean, the reality is that right now in the United States, you and I are having to pay taxes of $160 to $180 billion this year in interest on the money that on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed back in the 80s to make things look good enough that he could get himself reelected in 84. You and I are paying the interest on it. So, go figure. I mean, you know, what's the deal here? 1-866-889-8894 is our telephone number. TomHartmann.com, our website, if you want to drop in. Tim in Illinois on the line. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for speaking truth to power.
There you go. I'm assuming you have, speaking of power, I'm assuming you have electricity there, Tim.
We do.
You're fortunate. You don't realize how much you miss it until you lose it. This is the first time in the 2 years that generator's been sitting out there that we've had to fire the thing up. Thank God it ran. Anyway, what's up?
Well, after you revealed what about Matthew Hogan being appointed interim director of the Fish and Wildlife Agency,
yes,
I rang up the Interior Department and got a spokesman for Gail Norton.
Yeah. Oh, really?
And his name is Hugh Vickery, and I asked him, what is up with this appointment of a man who some would say has a conflict of interest due to his affiliation with the Safari community, the Safari Club,
mm-hmm.
International.
Right.
And his response was, quote, "We're proud to have someone from a hook and bullet background."
Yeah.
No apology.
We are proud to put the foxes in charge of the hen house. After all, those hens need a few good foxes in there.
there's more.
Okay.
No apologies here. It is appropriate to have someone from the hunting and fishing community. It's not a conflict of interest. The Safari Club has been the backbone of wildlife conservation in the United States and is a major contributor to international conservation of species in other countries. A little spinach?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, what's interesting, Tim, is that this is interesting. Louise called Green Mountain Power. They say a lot of Montpelier is down due to an equipment failure. Power will be out for 2 to 3 hours. So during the breaks, we will check the gas in the generator. Anyhow, what's interesting about this, Tim, is that there is actually some truth to that. And this is the interesting coalition that is forming, and that is that all across America, there are people who are hunters, fishers, people, fishermen, people who enjoy the wild areas of our country by, you know, in that way, as predators. And the human race has a long tradition of this. I'm not going to specifically criticize it, although it's not my thing at all. And they are very concerned about Bush administration policies that are basically throwing the whole thing in the toilet. That are, you know, putting roads into roadless wilderness areas, that are polluting the waters, that are killing the fish, that are killing. I mean, they're very concerned about these things, and legitimately so. So I think that there is a reasonable argument to be made to say, you know, having somebody involved in fish and game who understands fish and game is a good thing, and there is some reality to the fact that the hunting and fishing bunch are concerned about the Bush administration. But this is over the top. I mean, this is over the top. This is the guy who is going to authorize permits to bring into the United States endangered species, and he's part of a club that runs around the world shooting endangered species and then trying to get them into the United States so they can hang them on their walls. I mean, this is over the
However,
top.
No apologies here.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Isn't that great?
It is amazing. Tim, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Tom in Minneapolis on the line. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Minneapolis to Ice Station Zebra.
There you go.
Okay, I just wanted to relate this story, you know.
Okay, we have a minute and a half this time.
Okay, good. I'll be quick. You know, it's like on the front lines fighting these right wingers. It's, you know, it's again our doing our part to fight these guys. And I'm listening to Minnesota Public Radio, and it's going on for like 45 minutes, and the host is really weak, and he's talking about how increasing the minimum wage will destroy jobs, blah blah blah, and how Europe is suffering and all that. So of course I had to get on the phone and relate my story of what?
Go ahead.
Anyway, so I said, well, if raising the minimum wage will cost jobs, why not lower it to 25 cents an hour like we had before the Republican Great Depression? And there was just silence, right? And then I said, you know, minimum wage is all about setting the floor and thereby raising all wages in relation to that floor. Just as strong labor union membership helps non-union workers because it raises the wages for everyone. And then I went on to say, and you know that the productivity gains have increased over the last 20 years, and you know that we haven't got a share of our productivity gains. So,
right,
you know, and I went on to Lester, Jeremy Rifkin, the European Dream Book, and all of that.
Yeah, and how did they respond? We got about five
seconds.
Oh, he
just was hemming and hawing, and he couldn't have no response because all these light softball questions these hosts ask, it's like that shill from the Mercury.
Exactly. Tom, the problem is that the folks on the left are not educated. They don't understand what you understand. I'm so glad you're there. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Don't you ever give up. 24 and a half minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Time for our daily report from Washington, D.C. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
What's happening in the belly of the beast today?
Well, President Bush is in Iowa, where he's speaking to people about Social Security reform. Senator Chuck Grassley is traveling with him. He's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. Grassley said just a couple of days ago that he didn't think that a bill would probably get to President Bush's desk, which is interesting that now he's traveling with the president. But, I mean, that's, you know, that's
now,
what you
now
do.
Now he is eating his words.
Apparently so. Now, the AARP are also in Iowa, where they are having rallies themselves and spending a considerable amount of money. Every time that the president goes somewhere, they're making sure that they are there and they're speaking out. President's Press Secretary Scott McClellan said earlier today that they look forward very much to working with the AARP and to finding common ground on this particular issue.
Yes, after they've trashed them and called them communists and gay-bashed them and, you know, That's right.
They apparently feel that they need the AARP on the same page, otherwise they're not going to get the Social Security reform that they
need. These guys are just such bullies. You know, they make the worst kinds of accusations. They beat people senseless, and then they say, oh, and we'd like to have you on our side. We'd like to have a bipartisan discussion. It's just incredible. I mean, it's like the behavior of a schoolyard bully. It's not the behavior of mature adults. I'm just continuously amazed.
This is, of course, Washington, D.C., and the behavior of mature adults is rarely seen.
Yeah, I suppose you're right.
There's degrees and degrees.
Yeah, and hope springs eternal. And I really believe that there was a time in this country, probably the majority of the life of this country, but certainly the majority of my lifetime, when actually people in Washington, D.C., agree with them or disagree with them, did behave like mature adults. I mean, you know, Tip O'Neill and Barry Goldwater would have it out on the floor of the Senate, and then they'd go out for dinner together.
I think this is one of the things that really very many in Congress, even if they subscribe to it themselves, do regret the lack of collegiality that people really do complain about in Washington, that you don't very often see senators of different parties going out to dinner together after fairly contentious hearings on the Hill. It just doesn't happen as much as it used to. The divisions are much deeper than they were.
Yeah, yeah. And it's truly tragic. It really is. So what else is going on?
So, meantime, as you know, there have been developments in the Terri Schiavo case. I think Washington was fairly surprised about this. I think also a lot of people thought that Terri Schiavo would by now, in fact, be dead, and so that it wouldn't matter what anybody was going to try and
this
do.
This court has not ruled, has it? I haven't checked the news in an hour and a half.
No, the court hasn't ruled, which is interesting because the fact that the court agreed even to hear that the possibility that maybe they will do something, which is as far as the court really went, and then didn't do something when Terri Schiavo's breathing has apparently speeded up and they don't think she has very long, is interesting. The Supreme Court's been very busy this week. It issued an age discrimination ruling today. It's always interesting to see where they come down on issues that in theory they themselves would be subject to, and of course age discrimination, when the average age of the Supreme Court is over 20, one of the few places where there is no age discrimination.
Yes.
They've actually made it easier for workers over 40 to allege age discrimination.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
That's interesting. So
basically,
was this a 5-4 decision, or was this a larger majority?
Let me see if I can just find it, actually.
Well, we've only got about 10 seconds, so.
I think the decision actually was unanimous.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Ah, it was 5-3 in one part, but unanimous in another part, which is very interesting. And Rehnquist didn't participate in the decision because it was heard. The thing was heard when he was out in November.
That's remarkable. Well, that's great. We'll get the rest of it from you tomorrow. So, Victoria Jones, thanks so much for calling in with your daily report from Washington, D.C., the Talk Radio News Service. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back.
Working hard to make a living, bringing shelter from the rain. A father's son left to carry all blue denim.
26 and a half minutes before the hour. Since this from the International Herald Tribune, again, this is worth talking about for a day. There's a lot of other things we're going to get into, and that we have, in fact, you know, along the way. But this is something I think it's really worth noting. Since the start of March, Bridgewater Associates, this is in this article by Daniel Altman in the International Herald Tribune, Bridgewater Associates, the manager of more than $100 billion of institutional and hedge fund money based in Westport, Connecticut, has been issuing warnings in its daily reports. One on March 11th, titled The Breakdown of the Dollar System, said, and I quote, "As we often say, we've seen this movie many times and we know the ending," end quote. People are now investment fund. Now, this is the rich talking to the rich. This is millionaires and billionaires talking to millionaires and billionaires. And they're starting to say to each other, you know, George W. Bush is doing serious damage. Bush, DeLay, Frist, Hastert. And for that matter, the conservative Democrats in the House and Senate who go along with them, they are doing serious damage. Damage to the United States of America, to our economy, to our future, to our children's future. They are doing serious damage to our stature around the world. They are putting us at risk. And if the dollar crashes, if these people, you know, if China, for example, whom we're borrowing hundreds of billions of dollars a year from, decides to stop loaning it to us one day, and it could be simply because it's the best thing for them to do economically. It could be, you know, because they've found other markets to buy their cheap junk or their high quality stuff. By the time it gets to that point, they're starting to make better and better stuff now that we're shipping more and more of our technology and our factories over there. I mean, we are literally disassembling factories, taking them apart and shipping the equipment over to China. This was done just last month in Michigan, for example. So, you know, if they were to say, or it could be over something like Taiwan, they could say, you know, hey, we're going to take Taiwan back. And if you try to defend them militarily, or even talk about it loudly, we'll simply stop buying your debt. We'll simply stop loaning you money so that you can buy stuff from us. And we will discover that we can't, that we're really in trouble because we don't make our own clothes anymore. We don't make our own stuff anymore. Hey, Ira, we got funny noises going on in here. Is the generator still running?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Something must have come on. You might want to turn the heat down to 40. I'm serious. I don't know what's going on here, but, you know, our power systems are flickering. They're making funny noises. So... And as I said, and hey, Ira, give the folks at Jones a call right now and tell them that if we go black, to drop in a show right away, okay? Please call them right this minute. Jones is our satellite provider. Anyhow, if enough people start thinking like Bridgewater Associates, the dollar will lose value rapidly. Bridgewater says it believes that the dollar is already beyond the point of no return. You know, in a way, it's ironic. It's interesting. In a way, our losing power here in central Vermont and having to power this show with a gallon of gasoline in a generator just sitting right outside the building is metaphorical for how the whole thing is happening here in the United States. I mean, we're holding this thing together with baling wire. It's just, it's baling wire. So anyhow, Bridgewater says it believes that the dollar is already beyond the point of no return to keep the currency at its current value. Be sure and tell them we think we're going to be just fine for the next couple of hours. To keep the dollar at the currency at its current value, private investors. How many times do you hear a radio show going through this? It's really fascinating. This is what happens when you live in a little town of 9,000 people out in the middle of the mountains. Private investors will have to buy more American securities as central banks desert them, said Robert Prince, the firm's co-chief investment officer. Before private investors will act, they need to see a higher rate of return. Okay, so here's the situation. People start to lose confidence in the dollar, and it's already starting to happen. We had the Central Bank of China just last week saying, well, you know, we're not really all that confident about the dollar. You had the Central Bank of South Korea, the dollar, you know, there was this incredible kind of international freakout for one day. Remember that 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago? Because the Central Bank of South Korea said, perhaps we should diversify our currency holdings. And so what happens is countries say, hey, you know, we have lost. We're sitting on $1 trillion that, you know, of debt. And it's worth 30% less than it was when George Bush came into office because his economic policies have driven the dollar into the tank. And so they're saying, you know, if you want us to continue to buy your debt, if you want us to continue to hold your currency, if you want us to continue propping you up, you're going to have to pay us a higher rate of return. We can get 5.5% rate of return right now on New Zealand bonds denominated in the New Zealand dollar, which is not going down. So why should we settle for a 3% rate of return or a 4% rate of return on U.S. Treasury bonds when the value of the dollar is dropping 10% every year? And, you know, it's a good question. And the answer, of course, is going to be, well, we'll just have to provide you with higher rates of return. And those higher rates of return are going to mean higher interest rates. And that, as David Walker, the comptroller of the currency, says, is the cruelest tax of all. Because the investor class can make it through just fine. You get higher interest rates, they simply move their investments into things that produce higher yields. They become the holders of the debt of the rest of us. They move into bonds. And now they're making those higher interest rates. But for the average homeowner in America, they can't afford to pay for their home. For somebody who wants to buy a car, they can't afford to buy the car. And those higher interest rates are meaning that people can't buy things on debt. And when people can't buy things on debt, particularly large things like houses and cars, I mean, they'll still run up their credit cards at Walmart, but they're not going to buy a new car. They'll wait a year to get a new car. And what's that going to do? It's going to mean less production, less industrial production in the United States, less housing manufacturing in the United States. And what's the outcome of that? Layoffs, fewer jobs, lower wages. And you have the exact same scenario that we had in the late 70s when Richard Nixon drove us into the same tank, into the same ditch. You know, with the help, you have to say, the help of Lyndon Johnson, LBJ and Richard Nixon, you have a war in Vietnam, it's costing a fortune, and you're going to borrow money to pay for it. And all that borrowing to pay for that war was like, well, you know, we'll just keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. And eventually the people you're borrowing from say, hey, you're going to keep borrowing from us? We're not sure you can pay us back. Or even if you can, you know, you're devaluing your currency, so you can pay us back with cheaper currency. We'd like a better rate of return. Thank you very much. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Kate in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Kate, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. That little beeping every now and then is kind of scary, but anyway.
Yeah, that's I think they call them UPS, uninterruptible power supplies, you know.
Oh, good. That's a sign that it's on, not that it's running out.
Well, no, what it means is that the power from the generator has dropped below 110 volts. That something.
You know,
I think
we need something like that for our national, you know, awareness.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's like
beeping
sound. It's meta. It's a great metaphor for what's going on.
I'm calling because what you were talking about, us still repaying the interest on Reagan's borrowing. The level of not being very well informed of the American people, myself included, I told an extremely intelligent and highly educated friend that, and he said, no, that's not true. Clinton paid off or got rid of the deficit. So can you set me straight on how did Clinton get rid of the deficit, and what does that have to do with the interest we're still paying on Reagan?
Sure. Let's use a human being example.
Okay.
Let's say that this month I go out and I run up $500 with a credit card debt, but my income only allows me to pay off $400 of it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a deficit this month of $100. That is, I pay off $400, but I charge $500, so I owe the credit card company $100. So I have this month a $100 deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's say that next month I do the exact same thing. I spend $500, but I only have $400 in income, so next month I have a $100 deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my total debt at the end of these 2 months is how much?
$200.
There you go. But my total deficit for the second month was only $100. Now, let's say the third month I only spent $400, and I still have $400 worth of income. So in the third month, my deficit has gone to zero, right?
Yes, for that month.
For that month. But my debt is still
$200. Yes.
So what has happened is when Ronald Reagan came into office, the national debt of the United States, not the deficit, the debt.
Oh, okay.
The national debt of the United States was about $870, $920, something like that, billion dollars, a little less than $1 trillion. Reagan and Bush Sr. ran it up to over $3 trillion.
Mm.
Bill Clinton, in the first few years of his administration, still was deficit spending. But the last 2 years of his administration, he reached the point where, now, there was some funny bookkeeping here because he was actually using Social Security money to make it look better than it was. But nonetheless, arguably, he reached the point where for 1 or 2 years, the last 2 years of his administration, he was actually not adding to our debt anymore. That is, the deficit had hit zero. In fact, there was a little bit of a surplus, and that surplus could be used to pay off the debt. But the debt was still standing at around $4.5-5 trillion. And now George W. has pushed it up over $7 trillion.
Oh, well, that really needs to be made clear, because I think, I mean, in the general mind, which is where I think most people pay attention to this stuff, with just the general alertness, not a specific alertness, but we just equate deficit with debt and think, oh, Clinton fixed that, good.
I know. And Clinton, number one, Clinton didn't fix it. I mean, you know, he fixed the deficit problem. And if we generated a surplus, then over maybe 20 or 30 years, we could have paid off the debt that Reagan ran up. But, you know, it would have taken a long, long time. I mean, you know, if you've got a surplus of, say, $30, $40 billion a year, and you've got a debt of $3 trillion, and you've got to pay it off, it's going to take a long time to pay it off, because that $3 trillion debt is generating interest payments every year. I mean, you know, we're paying, like I said, we're paying $180 billion this year in interest just on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up.
Okay, that sets me straight. I'll have to take a while to process it, but
yeah,
thank
because
you very
to,
much.
To go back to our personal example here, mm-hmm. in that third month, I still owe my credit card company $200, even though I'm now earning $400 and spending $400. What does the credit card company want from me? Not just $200.
Mm-hmm.
They want $200 plus their interest.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same with governments.
Wow, very interesting. Thank you, Tom.
Sure. Thanks for the call, Kate.
Okay,
I appreciate it. It's, yeah, Kate makes a really good point. I'll bet that probably 98% of Americans don't understand the distinction between the national debt and the national deficit. And when George W. Bush goes on TV and says, oh, we've got a plan to cut the national deficit in half in 10 years. I mean, it's like, oh, we're gonna go from earning $400 and spending $500 a month down to earning $400 and spending $450 a month. That's not gonna help. I'm sorry. It's every single month the situation gets worse. Ed in San Juan, California. Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Not much. It's another beautiful day out here. Sorry, you don't have any electricity.
Well, you know, Ed, if things keep going the way they are with, you know, Bush and these guys and the Middle East decides to, you know, some of these Middle Eastern countries decide to start cutting us off from oil, I might not be the only one with no electricity.
Wouldn't that be great?
Well, you know, we've been
radio
there.
By candle.
I we've seen that movie before, as we say. I remember 1972. Louise and I were living in Detroit. I was working for RCA at the time to get the health insurance because she was pregnant with our oldest child, and I was working as an engineer at RCA, and that was when the big oil wax, you know, hit because of the 6 day war. And I remember in Detroit, all of the stores went empty. I mean, in 2 or 3 days, there was no food in the stores. People were, you know, based on whether your license plate ended with an odd or even number, you could get your money, your gas on,
yep.
you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. People were shooting each other in line. I mean, there were murders, and we were really worried. I mean, I remember we were in our 20s. I remember being worried about whether we would have food. And I mean, this is pretty scary stuff when you're living in a city of a few million people.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how fragile the system was. And Jimmy Carter said, we've got to do something about that. And Ronald Reagan said, no, we don't. And we've been in that no, we don't mode ever since. And that's part of the problem.
But, you know, I think the problem is that most of us think we can work our way out of it no matter what happens. If all our business is over in China, we'll build new machines.
Yeah,
we'll
right.
do this.
Yeah. No.
So what I was trying to do, though, is when the economy collapses, could I get a picture of you so I can get your picture on the $100 Hartman?
Yeah, we'll go back to the way it was before the before
you
the
know,
Fed.
The $5
you know,
Ed bill.
Yeah, the individual banks issuing their own currencies or individual states issuing their own currencies.
See, we think we can work our way out of it.
We actually have a currency here in Vermont. There is a local currency that is used, and local stores use them so that I'm drawing a blank on the name of it right at the moment, but I've used
food
them.
Food stamps?
No. It's an actual currency that's issued by a local group, and local stores will accept them, and you can only spend them locally, and it's to keep the local economy local. And it's,
they were green stamps, Tom.
Well, no. There's a movement all across America to do this, to generate these local currencies.
Barter?
It really is basically a form of barter.
Hey, Tom. Have a great day.
I know what they're called. They're called the Green Mountain Hours. And each one represents roughly $10 or 1 hour of labor. Ed, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 10 minutes before the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lintball.
This is the old Brush Show, Brush Lintball.
To tell you about DemocraticMatch.com. You're listening to Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, Daddy didn't like trouble, but if it came along, everyone that knew him knew which side that he'd be on.
There you go.
He never was a hero for this county's shining light. But you could always find him standing up for what he thought was right.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Chuck in Los Alamos, New Mexico, on the line. Hey, Chuck, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Yeah, well, we're still here.
Yep. Congratulations.
We discovered that if we unplugged the refrigerator, that the system didn't beep as much.
Well, there you go. Hey, listen, have you seen this book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman?
Oh, yeah. I know John Perkins. In fact, I had him on the program. I've read the book.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah,
because I was thinking that the United States is I think the Chinese and the Asians have read this book because they're doing to the United States exactly what we did to the third world.
Yeah, and if you want to go back 10, 15 years, read The Japanese Conspiracy by Marvin Wolf.
Great book.
This is nothing new, and pretty much everybody in the world understands all this stuff. So
I guess the question is when are they going to start putting a lien on our physical assets?
Well, they already are. They're buying up companies left and right. If you look at the roles of ownership of companies in various counties around the United States, you discover 5-10% of most counties in the United States are now owned by foreign countries. You've got Toyota on TV advertising about we're a wonderful company. We're employing Americans. Well, that's great, but where are the profits going? Well, they're going to Japan, but they don't tell you that in the ads. I mean, this is the problem. You sell off America, where do the profits go? They go to, the country sold it off to.
Well, they're going to start owning things like our timber industry. I mean, our natural assets are going to own everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and very quickly they are.
Yeah.
I got to move along, Chuck. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Henry in Michigan on the line. Hey, Henry.
Hi, Tom.
We got about 30 seconds. What's up?
Okay, what was the bit you were saying about the exotic animals, the hunters?
Oh, yeah, the guy who is a lobbyist for this game club of people who go around the country around the world shooting endangered species. He's now been put in charge of the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Well, that sounds like something that Ted the Nugent Nutt.
Yeah.
That used to be in Michigan, and thank God he's down in Crawford, Texas now, might have come up with.
Yeah, it's the fox in the hen house thing. I mean, it's characteristic, actually, of this administration. In almost every case, they've been putting people, instead of public servants, instead of people who view their job as to protect the interests of we the people, they've been putting people into government positions, particularly regulatory positions, who protect the interests of the industry, right? And then
it's all about corporate greed, you know. Corporate greed sucks.
There you go. You're like the black hole. I mean, it's just inhaling our wealth. It's inhaling our future. It's inhaling our children's future. It's inhaling our nation. We have to do something about it. You and me. The way we do it is we get politically active.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
How can there be...
Calling for a wrap. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Still cooking with guests, Olean. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where democracy will not be downsized, where despair is not an option, truth and common sense in broadcasting. Fortune 500 companies that invested millions of dollars in electing Republicans, notes Jim Vanderhey in the Washington Post. Fortune 500 companies that invested millions of dollars in electing Republicans are emerging as the biggest beneficiaries of a government controlled by President Bush and the largest grand old party House and Senate majority in a half century. For example, MBNA Corporation, the credit card behemoth and fifth largest contributor to Bush's two presidential campaigns, is among those on the verge of prevailing in an eight-year fight to curtail personal bankruptcies. ExxonMobil Corp. and others are close to winning the right to drill for oil in Alaska's wildlife refuge, which they've tried to pass for better than a decade. Walmart Stores, another big contributor to Bush and the GOP, and other big companies recently won long-sought protections from class action lawsuits. We are there. We are there. It's not the look out, we're going to end up with government of, by, and for multinational. We're there. What happened to government of, by, and for we the people? That government that Abraham Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address so eloquently spoke of and said shall not perish from the earth. Charles R. Black, Jr., a GOP lobbyist and one of the president's top fundraisers, says these, speaking of things like the bankruptcy bill and the class action lawsuit ban at the state level, these are not real high-profile sexy issues like the war or Social Security, but these are issues that have huge economic consequences, and there is more to come on that score. Aren't you reassured? Bush and his congressional allies, notes the Washington Post, are looking to pass legal protections for drug companies, doctors, gun manufacturers, and asbestos manufacturers, as well as tax breaks for all companies, that is, would be all large companies, and energy, because a lot of the smaller companies, their taxes, little sub-S corporations, they're tied to individual income. The average personal income of the average small business owner in the United States is around $62,000 a year. These are not the folks that are getting the big bucks and the big breaks, I'll tell you that. Bush and his congressional allies are looking to pass legal protections for drug companies, doctors, gun manufacturers, and asbestos manufacturers, as well as tax breaks for all companies and energy-related assistance sought by the oil and gas industry. In the 2004 elections, Republicans received 66% of corporate political action committee money. And frankly, I'm concerned about the Democrats who received the other, what would that be, 34%? Or 44%, the other 44%. Credit card and banking companies who are leading the lobbying effort, notes the Washington Post, were the top financiers of Bush's two campaigns. MBNA, Credit Suisse First Boston LLC, Bank of America Corp., and Wachovia Corp. were among the top 20 contributors to Bush, contributing more than $300,000 each. Ford Credit Company and others would benefit from a provision that stipulates that all automobile loans would be paid in full. Now, this I had wondered about, for example, Debbie Stabenow in Michigan. Here's somebody representing, auto country. Why would she be in favor of the bankruptcy bill? Well, it turns out under the old bankruptcy law, or under the existing bankruptcy law, if you go bankrupt, you have to pay for under Chapter 13, the reorganization where you actually pay your debts, you actually only have to pay not what your loan on your car is, but what the value of your car is. So if your car, say, for example, you bought a brand new car for $20,000. Well, it depreciates 10-15% as soon as you drive it off the lot. You declare bankruptcy 6 months later. It's not worth $20,000 anymore. It's worth $12,000 or $13,000 as a used car, but you still owe $20,000 on it. So under the current bankruptcy laws, you'd only have to pay that $12,000 or $13,000, whatever it would be worth at sale. Because the whole point of it is that if you can't pay it off, they're going to sell it, and they're going to take that money and distribute it to your creditors. I mean, there's a certain logic to this, actually. But under this new bankruptcy law that passed the Senate with the help of the Dirty 18 Democratic senators, under this new bankruptcy law that is coming before the House next week in all probability, you will have to pay off the full $20,000. You can't even sell a car and pay it off. I mean, you know, it just won't work. And so you've got the automakers on board for this. And you know, and on it goes. Ford Motor Company donated more than 80% of its PAC money to the GOP. ExxonMobil, which was the largest contributor among energy companies in 2004, has given $5.2 million to Republicans in the last decade and only $650,000 to Democrats over the last 10 years. Bush received $2.5 million from oil and gas companies for his reelection bid alone. You know, when you think about it, they're really pretty cheap. I mean, here we have a few million, 100,000 here, a million there, 5 million there, 2.5 million here, that are being given to the politicians. And the politicians then are making decisions, passing laws, that are going to give these companies billions with a B. This is just an investment. This is really very cheap bribery. Bribery is what we called it in the United States for the first 180 years of our republic, more or less. Up until basically the late 1970s, Buckley versus Vallejo and First National Bank of Boston versus Bilotti Supreme Court decisions. Up until that time in the late 70s, in the early 80s, up until the Reagan era, basically, we refer to this kind of thing as bribery. Now we call it business as usual. Lauren Kerr, spokesman for ExxonMobil, said the company had been clear about its support for allowing drilling in Anwar and transparent about its political activities. So, in other words, because they've been saying, yes, we've been trying to pay off these politicians. For years, we've been trying to pay them off. That makes it just fine. Look at the 10 biggest donors to Bush and the GOP. This was a graph that the Washington Post had. The number one, Morgan Stanley, $746,000. It must be $1,000. $746.4, and it's in thousands. So that must be $746,000 to George W. Bush. The second, Merrill Lynch, $712,000. The next one, PricewaterhouseCoopers, $641,000. Are you starting to detect a trend here that might have something to do with bankruptcy laws or Social Security privatization? Number three, UBS America. For number four, UBS America. Number five, MBNA, $595,000. Number six, Goldman Sachs. Number seven, Credit Suisse First Boston. Number eight, Ernst & Young. Number nine, Citigroup. Number 10, Vincent and Elkins. Very interesting. In total donations, we find that the Altria Group, this is used to be known as the Philip Morris Tobacco, they gave $13.19 million to Republicans, only $3 million only to Democrats. FedEx, $10 million to Republicans, $5 million to Democrats. UPS, almost $9 million to Republicans, $3.6 million to Democrats. AT&T, $8.3 million to... They're all hedging their bets. They're all hedging their bets. MBNA, $7.3 million to Republicans, only $1.62 million to Democrats. And they figured maybe the Democrats won't be in favor of all this stuff. What are your thoughts on this, beautiful Wednesday afternoon here? 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into our chat room. Gene in Hillsboro, Oregon on the line. Hey, Gene, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Actually, I'm still in last hour about the your local currency there in Vermont.
The Green Mountain Hours, they call it. Some people refer to them incorrectly as Green Mountain Dollars. And each one is worth about $10, and you can use them in local stores.
I was going to ask you real quick, just a couple of quick questions. What's the official name of the movement across the U.S. to have independent currency?
You know, I honestly don't remember. I wrote a chapter about it in one of my books. I believe it was in Unequal Protection. And there is a name for this movement, and it is quite active, and there's a whole bunch of them out there. And if you type local currencies into Google, it'll come out. And probably, well, in fact, I know somebody, folks in my chat room, let us know what the name of this local currency movement is, so I can share it. Somebody there, I'll figure it out and let us know very quickly. Very good about that.
The other thing that I thought is, you hear occasionally, every once in a while, about this national sales tax, the idea that the Bush administration sometimes wants to float. And I was wondering, this might be a nice way around that. But anyway, that's just my idea.
Well, actually, though, it doesn't get around any kind of taxes, because when companies receive these Green Mountain dollars, they ring them up in their cash registers just as if they were cash. The only difference is at the end of the day, they can't take them and deposit them in the local bank. They can only use them to buy things from other local vendors. So you've got, you know, local Annie's Naturals, for example, which sells all across the United States. They make sauces, you know, ketchup and mayonnaise and salad dressings and things and hot sauces. They make them right here in Vermont. In fact, probably about 15 miles from where we are. So a store could buy from them with this local currency. They could then pay the people who are picking the because a lot of their stuff comes from Vermont farmers. They could pay them. Then the Vermont farmers could go into the local stores and buy their clothes or whatever. And so it keeps the money circulating. But if you show up at McDonald's with one of these things, they won't let you in.
Shucks. Yeah. Well,
and that's the whole point of it is, you know, let's have a currency that encourages local economies.
Still sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I'm telling you, it's a great idea. And nobody in our chat room has come up with the name of it yet, but I'm confident somebody will. Hey, guys, that's assuming that they're still listening to the show. I think we're still streaming. So,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so we'll find out, and I'll let you know. I'll report back after the break, Gene.
Thanks
for calling. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Paul in Maryland on the line. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. About privacy or the rights of people to do things in public places, I got a disturbing email today from a coworker friend of mine. We're both locomotive engineers here in the Baltimore, Washington area. And he was down in downtown D.C. at LaFont Plaza taking a picture of a view of the railroad tracks that showed the U.S. Capitol. And he was waiting for a train to come by, and he waited there for a while, and a cop noticed him and came over and asked him what he was doing and told him he was taking a picture of a train. And
a train spotter.
Can't do that. What?
He's a train spotter.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. We're generally the term in this country is rail fan.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Yeah.
In the UK, they call
him. He also is doing a mapping project for the railroad, too. So he has permission to be wherever on the property doing that. And he has a letter that says so.
Right. Paul, we got about 20 seconds. You want to get to the punchline?
Okay. Well, at any rate, this cop went away, got some other cops. They came up. He showed them everything he had, his ID, his company ID, the letter of permission. They still wrote down, apparently, a terrorist watch card on him.
Oh, geez. So yeah. He's going to have great fun getting on an airplane. I mean, this is what is happening. These guys are turning this country into a gulag. And all around the world, people are looking at us going, what is going on? They're just baffled and mystified. Paul, thanks for the call, and
sure.
I think. Thanks for the grim story. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. It's called the local currency movement. I think my first guess was right.
We'll be marching in the streets with our children at our feet. In tomorrow's today, worship will be gone.
Yes, indeed. Plug local currency into Google, you'll get it all. In fact, Ithaca, New York, is one of the major cities that is doing this, and as well as cities in Vermont. Localcurrency.org is a website for that information. And also communitycurrency.org has resources on this. And, of course, for the Green Mountain Hours, the currency here in Vermont that I was talking about, that's greenmountainhours.org. Thank you so much for Pugla 46. I'm sure I'm pronouncing these wrong. Lakota 4. Sue over in England. A whole bunch of folks here in our chat room who have dug these things out while I was running around shutting off the generator and bringing the power back up. The city of Montpelier, Vermont, is once again online, and so we are too. And so our affiliates can relax, and the folks at Jones, you can take a deep breath, and everything's fine. And thank you. Thank you, everybody, for standing by. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Logan?
Good. I just wanted to make the point that, you know, we often talk about how these neocons and the corporations are sort of allied, but I do think that they have divergent interests in many ways, and they have divergent goals, and I think there is a lot of room for dissension between the two, and I think we saw that in Iraq with the oil fields. And I think that, you know, as the neocons get more and more ideology, you know, in their ideology, it seems like they might actually piss off some of these corporations. They might want to go Democrat.
Well, they already have. I mean, this was the big expose that Greg Palast just did that was published in Harper's Magazine and broadcast on the BBC, which was that there was this battle going on in the Bush administration back before 9/11. Oh, everybody agreed we were going to take out Iraq. But there was a battle between the neocons who wanted to take out Iraq to establish democracy in the Middle East and make it safe for Israel and make it safe for our oil interests, blah, blah, blah. But in a very kind of philosophically pure way, shall we say. And the oil lobby, represented largely by Dick Cheney and Ken Lay, who wanted to take Iraq so that we could simply hand off their oil to the big oil companies. And the crux of the debate was whether or not Iraq's oil should be privatized, which is what the neocons felt. They felt that the individual corporations should be allowed to buy it, the way that Russia's oil was privatized, for example, when the Soviet Union fell. Or whether, and oddly enough, the big oil companies felt this way, or whether it should stay nationalized, that is, the people of Iraq should continue to own the oil of Iraq, and then they would just sell it to the highest bidder. And the reason why the oil companies, the big multinational oil companies based in the United States, ExxonMobil and whatnot, were arguing to keep it nationalized was because they were concerned that if it was privatized, then Dutch Royal Shell and British Petroleum, who are very powerful in that part of the world and are certainly physically much closer, and Lukos, the new Soviet giant oil company, and perhaps even local Iraqi oil companies, in fact, probably Iraqi oil companies, if what the Russian experience was any indicator, would end up owning the oil. And then they would have to buy it from a company rather than a country. And it's a lot harder to corrupt a company, and the company's going to want to make a profit on it, so the price is going to be a little higher, and so it wouldn't be as profitable for them. And so there's this big argument within the Bush administration over whether the oil in Iraq that they were going to take should be publicly or privately held. And this was, as I said, before 9/11. And
It seems like there's room for disagreement, and you know they're not exactly always seeing eye to eye, and that probably inhibits their ability to take over.
I think. Well, then what's happened, and what we're seeing right now with John Bolton and Paul Wolfowitz, is that the neocons are being promoted up. You know, they're being promoted sideways, or they're being promoted up. They're basically getting them out of the way. Because they don't want to punish them. They don't want there to be obvious public risks. But they're
rocking the boat too much.
That's right. They're losing power. They're absolutely losing power. Logan, thanks for the call, and thanks for raising these. These are the issues of our day, and it's amazing how little they are discussed. I'm quite impressed, Logan. You're right on top of this stuff. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
A party at Ed's house.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I got to tell you, just the coolest stuff happens when you give money to the Republicans. It's like nothing like this happened when I gave money to the Democrats. I actually, you know, when Dean was running, I sent $25 off. I sent $25 to Barbara Boxer once. I sent $25 to the DNC. You know, altogether, probably, I don't know, $75, something like that. I'm not a big political donor, frankly. I'm not Mr. Big Bucks to begin with. So, but, you know, I sent them some money, and it was in good faith. And when the Republican Party came to me and solicited me for contributions, I sent them $5. And the reason why was because I wanted to be on their mailing list. I wanted to find out what they're sending to people who give them money. And I just have to tell you what happened here. During the break, we were just on a break, and Louise came in and handed me this very, very nicely done envelope. 2005, the return address simply says 2005 Republican Party Platinum Member. And then there's the seal of the Republican National Committee with the eagle, and there's an actual stamp on it. This is USA Nonprofit Org, and it has my name and address. And it's on Classic Laid, which is a type of paper that's very expensive bond paper, and, you know, with the texture to it, right? And on the back, it has the address in Washington, D.C., and I open it up, and inside is, honest to goodness, a platinum card. I have a platinum card. It's got the Republican National Committee's seal on it, and it has, you know, my name printed on it, you know, Mr. Tom Hartman, complete with my member number and member since. Let's see if this member number makes any sense. No, it doesn't have any relationship to my phone number or my Social Security number. Or anything. It's just some number they made up, apparently. And then this letter from Mr. Metrosexual, Ken Melman. He says, Mr. Hartman, I believe your exemplary record of loyalty and patriotism proves you are of the caliber of leader President Bush can count on in this important struggle. Now, as we fight terrorism and work for a strong, secure America, our challenge is clear. We must give President George W. Bush the support he needs to do what is right for our country by cutting taxes, modernizing Social Security, and strengthening our military. It is therefore, now this is in bold type, set off from everything else. It is therefore my distinct privilege as chairman of the Republican National Committee, parenthesis, RNC, close parenthesis, to present you with your 2005 Republican Party Platinum Card on behalf of President Bush and every Republican leader nationwide. I hope you will be as proud to carry this exclusive card as I am to have the honor of presenting it to you. And then they go on to, then there's a gotcha. You know, it's sort of like, you know, this is what's going to happen to these poor people who are on Terry Schiavo's mailing list that these same cons are selling now. He says, so when you remove your card, so the card's glued to a piece of paper, and the piece of paper has printed on the top of it, to Ken Melman, chairman, yes, Ken, I received my platinum card in excellent condition. I'm proud to accept it. I know President Bush is counting on me. I'm enclosing my contribution of $1,000, $500, $250, $100, $50, $25, or other. I'm going to check other, and I'm going to send him a check for $1 and see what happens. It's remarkable. So anyhow, he says, so when you remove your card, will you sign the accompanying receipt confirmation and send it back to me in tomorrow's mail? I've asked my staff here at the RNC to carefully track every card issued. If your confirmation is not received in the next few days, I'll have to assume your platinum card was not delivered, and I'll need to go to the extra expense of ordering and sending a new one. So please don't forget to mail it right away. I love it. I mean, these guys are really good. You have to hand it to them. They are really good. I can just see, you know, well, I don't want to pick on my parents. They're good Republicans, and they have a picture of George Bush on the wall next to the picture of me. But I can just see average Republicans all over the country getting one of these things. Anybody who's ever sent them more than, well, I sent them $5. So anybody who's ever sent them $5 or more getting their platinum card and going, holy cow, I must be really important. I mean, my member number is printed on here and everything. This is remarkable stuff. So I'm sorry. I just had to share that with you. This little moment of levity in an otherwise unremarkable but very strange day. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Harriet in Seattle on the line. Hey, Harriet, how are things going out there? I'll bet you didn't get a platinum card from George Bush and Ken Melman.
No, I sure didn't.
You missed your opportunity, Harriet.
I'm going to have to find a place to contribute, see if I can get one.
Yeah, I tell you, it is just so cool to get on their mailing list. The same thing, you know, I signed up as a conservative talk show host over at the Heritage Foundation and whatnot, and I get the most amazing things in email every day. That, you know, I know I can tell you in advance every morning what Sean Hannity is going to be talking about that day. I get the talking points, and it's just a hoot because so often they're so inane. But that's a whole other discussion. What did you call about?
Well, I just get the technology review. I think I need to expand my horizons.
There you go.
But when you look at that, actually, though, it's a outstanding piece of marketing considering their target audience, and you're not their target audience.
That's right. Yeah, I view it as high comedy, but yeah. Their target audience is going to be very impressed.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing, too, doesn't Visa have a platinum card? You might send them a question back, say, a platinum card, can I use that as a credit card? Wow.
I need to write some really, really genuine-looking, very naive letter, you know.
Yes.
You and I both know it won't be answered.
I know. But anyway, my comment was, I was foolishly watching CNN last night and watching the endless repetition of this clock ticking, and the Democrats haven't come up with any ideas for Social Security, and neither are the Republicans. But it occurs to me, nobody's saying anything about this. Where's Howard Dean? Where's the DNC?
With regard to Social Security, they are laying low, and they are wise to do so. Because
Why? Because
the reality is, Harriet, that if, first of all, there are two realities here. The first one is that we really don't have to do anything about this for 20 or 30 years. I mean, it's really that simple. Social Security has always been a pay-as-you-go kind of program. And when prior to 1970, I think it was 72 or 80, must have been 82 because it was when Reagan was president. Prior to 82, basically Social Security paid out based on what it brought in. And over the years, they raised the Social Security tax to accommodate that. I mean, it started out at 0.1%, and even in the 50s, it was around 1%. In the 60s, it went up to around 2%. I've got the chart around here someplace. It wasn't until the 70s that it got up into the 5, 6, 7% range. And so it's always been basically a pay-as-you-go program. And then in the 80s, they said, you know, we've got this chunk of people coming along, this unusual demographic bulge, this rabbit moving through the anaconda, you know, and we need to save up enough money in advance to be able to pay for when these people retire. And so they increased the Social Security tax above what was actually needed back in, as I recall, 82, and started putting that money away in the Social Security Trust Fund. And people think that the Social Security Trust Fund's been around forever. It hasn't. It's a recent invention just to pay off the baby boomers. And when that Social Security Trust Fund, and of course we're going to start spending out of that in 2012 or 2013 or 2014, and it's going to last until 2040, 2041, 2042, and then we're going to have to start paying out of general revenues. Well, if we don't do anything until 2040, on 2040, we'll probably have to raise the Social Security tax by 1 or 2%. And it'll just keep on going.
I know this. I'm looking at the target audience of the platinum card.
Yeah.
There's nothing coming out to rebut this.
But the Democrats are in this situation where it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. If they say, oh, well, we should cut benefits, they'll get jumped on. If they say, oh, we should raise taxes, they'll get jumped on. And ultimately, one of those two things or both is what's going to have to be done. It's just that it doesn't have to be done for another 30 years.
Well, that's true. But the thing is, if you don't have to propose anything. You just have to point out the fallacy of their argument.
Well, they've been doing that all along. And they've been saying it. And the reason that they're not getting covered on that, and Howard Dean has come out and said this, is that, oh, they already said that. Well, it's not news anymore. You see, it's only news when you say something new, or if you happen to be the president and you can call a press conference.
Yeah, but they're not saying anything new either.
No, of course not. But that's the situation. And frankly, I think the Democrats are wise in keeping their heads down on this for the moment.
Okay. Well, we'll agree to differ a little bit on that one.
Okay. Well, I don't pretend to be a Democratic strategist. I'm not even a member of the Democratic Party. I voted for a Democrat for president last time. I voted for Green the time before that. I by and large, my sentiments are with the Democratic Party. If they would get back to their, being the party of the people.
That's it. And in that regard, where's Dean? I haven't gotten anything from anybody about anything.
Well, they're doing this tour around these red states, and my understanding is the Dean's out there and he's doing quite a bit. It's just getting no coverage. There's a media blackout on it. But yeah, I mean, if you learn any, you're running the Democratic Forum on CompuServe. Put the signals out, put the feelers out, and if you find out anything, call us up and let us know.
Okay, I'll give that a try.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
Thanks, Harriet. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. 16 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Here, speaking of solutions for Social Security, this from Sandy. Sandy doesn't say where. Oh, in Clackamas, Oregon. Sandy in Clackamas, Oregon says. Offers a solution, and I think this is absolutely brilliant. Sandy's solution, and I'm not sure if this is a he or she, Sandy, but Sandy's solution is exempt the first $20,000 that a person earns, but still pay them full benefits. This gives everyone under $100,000, because right now the first $80,000 you pay FICA tax on, you pay Social Security tax on. So if you exempt the first $20,000 and then eliminate the cap, so even Bill Gates is paying Social Security at the same percentage rate that you and I are, because he's not right now. Eliminate the cap. That means that everybody making under $100,000 is going to get an actual cut in their Social Security tax. Everybody earning over $100,000 is going to have to suddenly start paying Social Security taxes on their income. Oh, horrors of horrors. The millionaires and the billionaires are going to have to start paying Social Security. Yes. And I think this would be brilliant. I mean, what a straightforward, simple, thoughtful, intelligent, articulate. I mean, this is great. Sandy, brilliant piece. That's a solution that the Democrats could be putting forward. But again, I mean, why say anything? Let the Republicans be the first to say something. They'll be the first to put something on the table. Because whoever goes first is going to get shot down. And we have seen this movie before where Democrats thought that they could be nice with Republicans. And they cooperated. Ted Kennedy, for example, going along with George Bush on the No Child Left Behind. And what happens? The Republicans get a hold of it. They destroy it. They turn it into a corporate welfare program. And then they vilify the Democrats who thought that they were doing the right thing. Sheldon in Maryland on the line. Hey, Sheldon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just got back from a town meeting with our local Republican congressman. And he made the point, he said that the trust fund is non-existent. And I challenged him on that, basically. I said it's because you filled up the trust fund with T-bills that are, claims on the Treasury of the United States. But it doesn't sound like you're planning to pay those back, that the money's going to have to come out of the general revenues. And this is something that they will finally have to account for in the budget. They've been borrowing out of Social Security right along.
Right.
And they are now trying to weasel on having to pay it back. And I said, it's just like I buy a T-bill, I expect to get paid back. And that's what Social Security Trust Fund has done. But it sounds like you're not planning to pay it back or consider it an obligation.
And what did he say?
He didn't have much of an answer. I got a good big hand from the
From the audience. See, this is the thing, Sheldon. Let me just explain this in a little more simple English, because I have a feeling that a lot of our listeners don't realize that this shell game has been being played, and it was played by the Clinton administration. It's been being played basically ever since the Reagan administration, and perhaps even the Carter administration. I'm not sure, but I know certainly since the Reagan administration, what they have been doing, and I believe that it started with the Reagan administration when they started going into major deficit spending. And in 82, it had to be the Reagan administration, because that's when they started the Social Security Trust Fund. Prior to that, Social Security brought in a dollar, spent out a dollar. Okay, Social Security then starts saving money to pay for the baby boomers. So they create this trust fund, this savings account. It's an extra savings account. There's now trillions of dollars. There's one point something trillion dollars, a little less than $2 trillion in that savings account. During the Reagan administration, during the Bush administration, during the Clinton administration, and during the George W. Bush administration, in order to make their deficits not look so bad, they have borrowed, say the Social Security Trust Fund has a $200 billion surplus for the year, which it was last year, more or less $200 billion. They simply borrow that money from it, and they give them, T-bills. And then they say, because this is intergovernment borrowing, they don't count that as part of the deficit. So they say the deficit's $400 billion this year, but actually we're borrowing $600 billion. We're just borrowing $200 billion of it from ourselves.
Exactly, and it financed the Bush tax cut.
Exactly, exactly. And the only way that that can be paid back is if we raise taxes and pay it back out of general revenue. And, well, and people don't get that. I mean,
I just want to reinforce what you said earlier, Tom, about getting active. We resuscitated a DFA group here in Salisbury, Maryland, and
good.
We had eight people at that meeting, and two of them got interviewed by the news afterwards. So
that's great, Sheldon. Sheldon, we're out of time.
There, and challenge them.
There you go. I appreciate the call. Keep up the great work.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Will you come down from your ivory tower?
Well, I just took a $1 bill and filled out the little form here for George W. Put a little note in it, personally handwrote it, said, you know, I'm a little short right now, so I can only send a dollar. Hope this is okay. Signed it, filled it out. Sending it back to the Republican National Committee, P.O. Box 96994, Washington, D.C., 20077. Hopefully the Postal Service will not intercept and steal my dollar. I don't think they will. I trust them. They're good union employees. We'll see what happens. I'll keep you up to date. Sue in the chat room. Sue, of course, is in the United Kingdom. So her perspective on these things is perhaps a little clearer than many of us who are here in the middle of it all. She says, will that platinum card get you into events with George W. Bush? And for me, it was like a forehead slap. Holy cow, I'll bet it will. I'll bet it will. Now when George W. comes to town and I show up and I say, you know, I'd like to be in the audience. And they'll say, all right, we don't know if we're going to allow you in or not. Because you know the story about these three people who were just led away. This was last Thursday or Friday. Three people were, they came in, they had tickets from their local congressman. They came in, they sat down to hear George W. give one of his sales pitches for privatizing Social Security, turning Social Security over to our corporate friends. And the police came in, or the Republican police, whatever they were. I mean, they don't, to this day, they don't. Big, burly guys with things in their ears and little red pins on their lapels wearing black suits came over and said, you have to leave. That's it. We're taking you out. You can't stay here. And they were like, why? You have to leave. So later, they actually inquired of the Secret Service, why were we evicted? Why were we evicted from this thing? And it was because the Republican Party had seen that the car that they drove in on, these are three unrelated people. Apparently one of them owned this car, or a friend of theirs. The car had a bumper sticker on it that said, no more blood for oil on it. And so they took all three of them and they threw them out. Now, this is an event that was paid for with your tax dollars and mine, our tax dollars and our Social Security tax dollars, where our president, the man responsible to us, who works for us, was supposed to be meeting with us. But apparently if us have a bumper sticker on our car that says, no more blood for oil, we are not allowed to be in that meeting. The government has now outsourced to the Republican goon squads the task of keeping pure the attendees to the functions for this 60-city tour that George W. is going on with your tax dollars and mine. Does this remind you of anything? This is just so eerily like the Stalinist single-party state. I'm not even, you know, going to go there with the Nazis. I mean, this is more like Joe Stalin. This is there shall be no dissent. There will be no dissent whatsoever. Anyone who speaks up is out. It's that simple. And this, I'm sorry, my friends, this is anti-American. The people who are doing this must hate the United States of America. They must hate the Constitution of the United States. I can come up with no other explanation. The First Amendment of the Constitution guarantees free speech, and it's political free speech. And the right of assembly to petition the government. And here we have, what other possible explanation could it, unless they live in fear of we the people. Maybe it's not that they hate us, maybe it's that they fear us. In which case, that's even scarier and even sadder. Tragic times, strange times we live in, my friends. Times that it's vitally important that we get involved.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.